A group of Arizonans wants to let Mexican visitors with border crossing cards travel through more of the state. And the state is working with the feds to try to make it happen.
To me, this is low-hanging fruit, something that makes sense from an economic standpoint and doesn't really present any kind of new or unusual security problems.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a federal court rules Tucson's election system is unconstitutional. Can a parade help heal the wounds of the VA scandal? And a new exhibit looks at photos of and about a famous painter.
There was this stream of people in the 1930s that came through, famous Mexican actors and actresses, people from the U.S.
Plus, hiking the Arizona Trail and landmarks you might not have known were landmarks. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon and a high of 69 degrees. 77 is average for today. We hit 81 yesterday. Clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-40s. Sunny and 69 again for tomorrow. Right now, it is 69 degrees at KJZZ. The Arizona Court of Appeals has upheld the conviction of a man who killed nine people in a Buddhist temple west of Phoenix 24 years ago. The court denied Jonathan Duty an appeal today. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
Jonathan Duty committed the nine crimes at the Wat Phrom Kinaram Temple in 1991. He was convicted twice and tried three times for those crimes and has already spent more than 20 years in prison. His attorneys claimed on appeal the court erred by not allowing certain evidence about a 10th murder committed by Alex Garcia. Garcia was the second person involved in the temple killings. He pled guilty, got life in prison, and agreed to testify against Duty. Duty argued the details of this murder are relevant to show Garcia is a serial killer who cuts deals with the state in exchange for favorable outcomes for himself. The appeals court ruled the trial court correctly used its discretion to limit the details of the 10th murder. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Tucson may have to come up with a new citywide election system. That's because the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals this morning ruled the city's current one is unconstitutional. To help explain what that system looks like and what comes next, we turn to Becky Palick, who covers the Tucson City Council for the Arizona Daily Star. So, Becky, what is Tucson's city election system now? Because it seems a bit different than what other cities use.
Yeah, Tucson has an unusual election system. There are six wards or districts, and the primary election is partisan and ward-specific. So each ward's Democrats choose a candidate to send to the ballot in November. Each ward's Republicans do the same. But then in the general election in November, it's a citywide election. And if that sounds weird, it is. There's only a few other cities that do it that way. There's a couple cities in California and Kentucky.
What did the court say about it?
So actually, a citizens committee had been talking about whether to change the election system here, but when they didn't make a decision this spring, a group of Republicans sued to try to force a change, and they were claiming that the system violates their 14th Amendment rights under the Equal Protection Clause, the one man, one vote protection. So first in May, a district court judge said Tucson's system is okay, and they said the city voters can set the rules for their own elections however they want to, but then the plaintiffs appealed and the Ninth Circuit panel of judges agreed with them and said Tucson's election system is unconstitutional.
Are city officials saying whether or not they plan to appeal this?
We don't know yet. The city council would have to give permission for that, and they don't meet again until next week. But I think Tucson is surprised about this. We've had this system in place since 1930, and it has survived a number of other legal challenges. But of course, the plaintiffs are pleased with the judge's opinion. They're calling this a great day for Tucson.
Are the challengers thinking that if the system is changed somehow, Republicans might have more representation on the city council?
Yes, and Republicans want to go to a ward-only system where each city council member would represent their own ward. So it's not unusual in Tucson to have results like the ones we saw last week, in which a Republican candidate, Margaret Burkholder, she won in her ward but lost citywide to the Democratic incumbent, Shirley Scott, and that's not unusual to have that kind of result in Tucson.
Will this court decision potentially impact the results of last week's elections?
We don't think so, but that same candidate, Margaret Burkholder, said she'd only run again if the city goes to a ward-specific election system, so it would definitely impact future elections. And what happens next is, I think, still up to voters. Only voters can change the city charter, which is like the city's constitution. So the city council will have to send a question to the ballot, letting voters decide whether they're going to go either to a ward-specific election system or to a citywide election system.
Becky Palick covers Tucson City Council for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson. We were talking about the court ruling this morning saying that Tucson's citywide election system is unconstitutional. Becky, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Arizona received a D in the latest report from the Center for Public Integrity. The study looked at areas like oversight of the legislature, governor's office and elections, lobbying and civil service protections. But that score was still good enough to put Arizona in the top half of states nationwide. For more on the report and what it means, I welcome Evan Wyloge, senior reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. And Evan, what did the report look at?
So we looked into 250 questions about transparency and accountability measures, both in law and how the law is carried out in state government.
And it looks like Arizona didn't really do all that well, at least grade-wise.
Grade-wise, we scored a D. We ranked 22nd out of the 50 states. I think that goes to show you that this was a very stringent report card, and it was a very high standard they were using.
I was going to ask you about that because Arizona scored a D, but was still basically in the top half of states nationwide. So I'm wondering what that tells you either about the report card or about the way states are doing.
I think it speaks to both. You know, this was a very stringent report card. They were looking for very high standards when it comes to these accountability and transparency measures. But, you know, a lot of states are deficient in several of these categories, and I think that shows.
Were there any areas in which Arizona did particularly well?
Yes. Arizona did pretty well when it comes to the judiciary and internal auditing. And I think that for anybody who pays close attention to state government here in Arizona, those probably don't come as much of a surprise. The judiciary here has a nonpartisan, very nonpolitical nominating and appointment process. It's also got very good ethics oversights and ethics advisory committees. The internal auditing, the Auditor General here in Arizona is also very nonpolitical. It's mostly like an accounting firm. They go through every state agency on a regular basis. There's very little interference from the executive or the legislature.
What were some of the areas in which Arizona really sort of needs to pick up its game?
Well, I think, you know, some things that stick out. It's no surprise that lobbying scored low. We have a pretty weak lobbying reporting system. There's roughly 85% of all lobbying dollars that don't include the beneficiary on the record, and that's because of loopholes that are built into the system. So that's one area where we scored pretty low, and I think that people who pay attention to lobbying closely probably aren't surprised by that. Another area where we scored real low is public access to information, and that one doesn't necessarily capture all the nuance in our laws here in Arizona. For instance, the measurement tool asked whether, you know, calendars of lawmakers or something like that, calendars of the executive office, are public record in law, and they're not. But Arizona's public records law is very broad, and those things are public record. The thing here in Arizona is that any government business is considered a public record unless it fits into very specific exemptions that are laid out in law.
When you talk about lobbying, there was obviously the big scandal with the Fiesta Bowl a few years ago, and there was some talk about banning all gifts or making more things reportable or somehow changing the lobbying laws, and nothing really came of it. So do you think that by issuing reports like this, I mean, do you expect things to change based on these?
Well, that's a good question. Expect them to change? I don't know. It's important to note that a lot of people looking into lobbying across the country have said that the best practice is either to ban everything entirely or to make everything reported. And we kind of have something in between those two here in Arizona. And if we were to see a change made to lobbying disclosure requirements and the lobbying oversight, because another area where we lost points is for the fact that nobody even looks at the reports. And if we wanted to change any of that, it would be on the lawmakers to make those changes. And there's very little incentive for them to do that.
Evan Wyloge is senior reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Evan, thanks.
Thank you.
Tomorrow is Veterans Day, and here in Arizona, that takes on a special meaning. The state is home to one of the highest percentages of veterans in the country, and was also at the epicenter of last year's VA hospital scandal. As KJZZ's Phil Latzman found out, veterans advocates are hoping to polish the state's tarnished reputation with a parade.
Thomas Winkle served in Operation Desert Storm and Desert Shield as a Marine combat infantryman. He now works directly with some of an estimated 600,000 veterans in the state as director of community engagement with the Arizona Coalition for Military Families.
Although it's 10% of the state's population, when you add in families, it's around 20% of the state's population. So that's a strong element to pay attention to. And the nice thing is, organizations are doing exactly that.
It hasn't always been that way. Winkle says even in veteran-rich Arizona, recognition of their plight is a relatively recent phenomenon.
I think the reality is what we've seen since the beginning, especially since the start of this most recent series of wars, is that the population is just coming to grips with an understanding that it really is partly their responsibility to engage with and support service members, veterans, and their families.
Helping raise even more awareness to their struggles was the scandal that enveloped VA hospitals last year, when it was revealed that thousands of veterans never received care at the Phoenix facility, with several deaths attributed to long waiting lists for appointments. Retired Air Force Colonel Wanda Wright is director of Arizona's Department of Veterans Affairs. She says the community has rallied around veterans since the federal VA's upheaval in 2014.
I believe what has occurred because of the issue is that there have been sort of continuum of care with community resources. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the nonprofits as well as state agencies have come together to support veterans.
And in ways that they did not before?
In ways that they may not have before.
And veterans like Mike Mitchell are proving that.
I think that, yes, the recent issues there across the nation have helped people focus on our veterans.
Mitchell served on active duty as an Army officer stationed in Europe. After receiving his law degree from Arizona State, he currently works in the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. But he's also devoted his post-military career to the service of fellow veterans as president of Honoring Arizona Veterans.
Arizona really takes its veterans seriously and pays great tribute to them throughout this whole week, with I think the signature event being our parade on Wednesday.
Due to systematic problems at the VA, that parade was in jeopardy a few years back until Mitchell's organization took over.
And I will say, to the VA's credit, this parade began with them, and I think what was a good decision by the VA is that this parade is now a private production and allows them to more focus on their mission of delivering care to veterans.
Serving as Grand Marshal of this year's Phoenix Veterans Day Parade is 95-year-old retired Army Sergeant Chester Doerr. 71 years ago, Doerr was among the infantrymen who stormed the beaches of Normandy.
I was lucky. I really lucky, because the first guys that went off on our landing craft went down, and I don't know what happened to them.
Doerr says he's used VA doctors in Phoenix recently and has had no complaints.
Well, they told me to try the VA, so I tried the VA, and I was very surprised. I got a very, very good treatment with the VA. Everything concludes with everything I had wished for. I can't complain about them one bit.
And as for what this 95-year-old American hero expects on Veterans Day?
I don't expect much, but I expect once in a while is if I wear that cap, or if they know I'm a veteran, if they just say, like they did today, thank you, veterans. That's the best thing that can happen.
And you can thank him and other local veterans in the parade tomorrow, which starts at 11 a.m. at North Phoenix Baptist Church on Montebello. It will eventually head east on Camelback. Phil Latzman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Still to come, finding some natural landmarks off the beaten path.
The Park Service can work with and cooperate with a variety of landowners to help encourage and assist in conservation of sites that extend beyond park boundaries.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Checking traffic, I-17 southbound, a collision at Indian School has the left lane blocked. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 69, which we have since exceeded. It'll be clear tonight, overnight lows in the upper 40s. Sunny for both tomorrow and Thursday with a high tomorrow of 69, up to 76 on Thursday. It's 71 degrees right now at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center, announcing the holiday tour of saxophonist Dave Koz and guest Candy Dulfer, Jonathan Butler, and Bill Medley, Wednesday, December 16th. Pre-show dinner option tickets and more at mesaartscenter.com.
A group of Arizonans wants the U.S. Homeland Security Department to extend the border crossing zone to include the entire state. Right now, Mexican travelers with a crossing card can come into Arizona and travel a specific distance from their port of entry. Advocates say allowing visitors to travel throughout Arizona would benefit the state's economy. Youngtown Mayor Michael LaVault is one of those advocates. He's also chair of the Maricopa Association of Governments Economic Development Committee.
In Nogales, for example, when they cross through that port of entry, that 75-mile travel radius gets them as far as Tucson. And there are literally thousands of Mexicans every day that are, a lot of them are walking across the border. Some of them are driving vehicles, but they cross the border. And there are literally a fleet of buses there waiting to transport them to Costco, Sam's Club, Walmart, places like that to do their shopping. And then they'll shop and get back on a bus and be transported to the border and go home.
If you were able to get that extended to include the Phoenix area, what would it mean for the Valley, and what would it mean for individual cities like yours?
Well, you know, we asked the University of Arizona to do a quick economic impact study for us, and the data that they looked at and analyzed showed that there would be something just under a $200 million injection of new money into the Arizona economy, and it would create something north of 2,000 new jobs. So it would be a fairly significant positive impact on the Arizona economy.
Have you heard any opposition to this, or are there some folks who don't want this to happen?
You know, I'm not aware of any. We're just now getting deeply into the process for asking. This would be a Department of Homeland Security issue that would have to be addressed there. We're just getting into that process. But so far, I haven't heard much, if any, opposition. It's important that we not conflate the issue of illegal immigration with extending the border crossing card into Arizona, because the folks who would be using that border crossing card, or BCC, are typically affluent middle-class Mexicans that are thoroughly vetted. They are fingerprinted, photographed. The card that they're issued, it has an RFID chip in it. It's a very secure document. So it's important that we not conflate those two issues, that is illegal immigration with users of the border crossing card, because they're two completely different subsets of people.
Do you have a sense of best-case scenario, assuming Homeland Security agrees with your position, how quickly this could be implemented?
Well, I think it's going to take some time. I think, optimistically, if we could get this reviewed by the end of next year, with a decision possibly late next year or early in 2017, I think that's probably kind of a realistic timeline to shoot for.
How would that compare to how other states have approached this? I mean, do other states have a radius that is as large as what you're proposing for Arizona?
You know, there's a precedent for extending the border, for example, in Arizona until, gosh, I don't know, 15 years ago, I think or maybe 10 years ago, I think the radius even down at Yuma or at Tucson was 25 miles. And when Congressman Colby, I think, was the individual that actually was able to get that radius extended to 75 miles. Then most recently, the state of New Mexico extended their border crossing radius, I think they're at 50 miles. I think this would be unique from the standpoint that we're asking Homeland Security to extend the border crossing card area into the entire state of Arizona. You know, because here's the thing. Again, you're talking largely about middle-class Mexicans that would like to come into Arizona and spend money. It just makes sense from an economic standpoint to give them access to the entire state because, as you know, one of the biggest draws for Arizona is tourism. To me, this is low-hanging fruit, something that makes sense from an economic standpoint and doesn't really present any kind of new or unusual security problems.
Michael Levant is the mayor of Youngtown and chairman of the Maricopa Association of Governments Economic Development Committee. There's a program within the National Park Service that works on land that is not necessarily part of the park system. In fact, not all of the land is even public. It's called the National Natural Landmarks Program, and it includes almost 600 sites around the country, 10 of which are in Arizona. You can read about each of those in the state in this month's edition of Arizona Highways Magazine. For more on the program and what it's all about, we turn to Heather Eggleston, acting manager of the National Natural Landmarks Program.
The program was established in 1962 by then Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall. And really the program aims to identify, recognize, and encourage the conservation of sites that contain significant natural features, so both biological and geological features. So the program is administered by the National Park Service, and it's really a nice conservation tool, a nice conservation partnership program where the Park Service can work with and cooperate with a variety of landowners to help encourage and assist in conservation of sites that extend beyond park boundaries.
What kinds of help do you offer the landowners?
So we can do a variety of different things. Oftentimes we can provide different types of technical assistance. So if a landowner is interested in perhaps learning some management recommendations, how best to address the issue, or perhaps do some restoration work. If we have cave sites that are privately owned and used in commercial operations, we can assist with, you know, lighting recommendations or trail surface recommendations. So a whole variety of different types of things that we can tap into the resources of the Park Service or even broker with other conservation organizations or land managing agencies to help provide some type of technical assistance. We also do a lot of advocacy, so we're an extra set of eyes and ears on the ground, paying attention to if there are projects out there that may potentially impact one of these sites. We certainly want to just make sure that people are aware that the designation at this site exists, what the significant resources are, and then hopefully work with those project managers to minimize any type of impact if possible to these sites.
How do sites get selected for this program?
They get selected in a couple of ways. So in the 70s and 80s, the Park Service actually contracted out with scientists to identify all the different types of natural features across the country, both biological and geological features, and then to identify some sites that contain some of those features, and so they may then warrant further evaluation to see if they would meet the national significance criteria for NNL designation. So we do have a list of, you know, really hundreds of potential sites, and so we can start there. Anybody can also suggest a site for designation, and when we go to select a site to evaluate for possible designation, we're usually looking at, you know, first trying to see where we have gaps in representation. So part of this program is, in addition to, you know, raising public awareness of these sites, it's also helping tell the story of the diversity of natural features across the country. So each of these sites kind of tells a little piece of that story. So initially, a lot of times we will look to see where do we have gaps in those representation, what types of ecological or geological features are not already represented.
and then try to select a site that may help fit that gap.
Once a site is brought into the program, does that offer any specific protections or other benefits to the site other than the fact that it's on this list?
Not per se. So the designation in and of itself does not protect a site. It does provide, again, that recognition that the area is nationally significant. It creates a partnership with the Park Service so that they can tap into resources from the Park Service, whether that's, again, that technical assistance, that general advocacy and support. And it really helps to raise public awareness. So really, in its truest sense, is a recognition.
Heather Eggleston is the acting manager of the National Natural Landmarks Program. You can read about the 10 Arizona sites with the designation in this month's Arizona Highways magazine. Every year, thousands of people decide to change their lives with a big vision and a backpack. Around here, that means heading out on the Arizona Trail, which runs the entire length of the state. KJZZ's Tina Sieg did just that.
I can't tell you exactly what drew me to the Arizona Trail, to try to follow it the 200 miles from Utah to Flagstaff. It was an itch, which turned into a hunger. As I planned and bought gear and dehydrated vegetables, the idea of spending 3 weeks alone in the Arizona outback became more real and enticing. Then it was here.
Let's do it.
5 miles from the trailhead. That's my dad dropping me off where the road became too washed out to keep driving. So I started my walk early, heading out alone, crunching into the sun-drenched desert, which didn't stay sunny for long. Okay, so I've gone exactly 1.1 miles, and now it's raining, and I'm literally sitting on the side of the trail holding an umbrella over all my stuff and wondering what to do next. The answer was a simple trash bag, and like I'd find out over and over again, to just keep walking without any distractions. It was harder than I thought, which hit me full force the next night as I ate dinner surrounded by dark mesas and bright stars.
It's really beautiful here. And what's crazy is how hard it is to actually just eat and not have the TV on or a YouTube video or something, just eating. It's so hard. It makes me feel like, like I have a lot to learn.
With each 10 or 15 mile day, I was detoxing from distraction and Diet Dr. Pepper, but I was choosing it, kind of looking forward to where it would take me whenever I pulled that heavy backpack over my shoulders.
Oh, God.
I started getting into the rhythm of this new life. Set up the tent, take it down. Cook meals, clean them up. Walk, sleep, walk. It wasn't easy, but it was simple. Always moving forward, with my umbrella for shade and solar panel on my pack for power, through waving meadows and shimmering aspen groves. I was constantly alone, passing more cows than people. But every once in a while, my dad would meet me in his RV with food, and a reminder that this whole experience was a gift.
You know, from the universe, really, that says, go forth. Become thyself.
Onward to the northern edge of the Grand Canyon, then down, down to the bottom. With only one fall along the way. The hike out was humbling. Reaching the top was momentous. I was 10 days and 100 miles in. Halfway, right on schedule. But now, surrounded by crowds of chatting tourists, I realized for the first time that I could quit if I wanted to. If I was really going to make it, I was going to have to dig in my heels and really choose it and keep choosing it. Especially as I fought my way across the wide open spaces that came next. After dozens of miles in the whipping wind, I stopped for some water my dad had left me under a tree. It hit me in that moment that if I didn't finish this trip, I'd be dragging it behind me forever. memories of those last few days blend together, a mix of more wind and mountain bikers and the reemergence of pine trees and Flagstaff, always tantalizingly close. Until there it was. I'd spent 19 days on the Arizona Trail when I veered off it, taking a right onto Route 66 toward my old life and my dad waiting at a brew pub.
Hey, Dad. Hey, Dad!
And then, with a hug, my hike was over.
Oh. You did it. You did it.
Well, come in and have lunch.
Soon I was downing French fries and mac and cheese and facing the fact that I was about to re-enter everyday existence. I was scared, but more than that, excited. If I can do this trail, what else is possible? Stina Sieg, KJZZ News.
Coming up, learning to love your body even when society tells you not to.
You have this like moment where you're like, oh my God, maybe I don't have to hate myself for the rest of my life. And it's scary and it doesn't make sense and it starts to sink in. You're like, oh my God, this is so wonderful. What do I do now?
That's ahead. It's the show. In Valley traffic, I-17 southbound, the collision at Indian School is now just blocking the shoulder, not any lanes anymore. Look for partly cloudy skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid to upper 40s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 69. It's partly sunny, 71 degrees at KJZZ at 2:35.
KJZZ is supported by Riley Carlock and Applewhite, a business law firm helping local and national clients with corporate and securities, water and environmental, labor and employment, and other areas of the law. Details at rcalaw.com.
Bank details, login passwords, security codes. Do you ever wonder where all that precious information you entrust to the internet gets stored? The answer is the cloud, a metaphor for the banks of computers used to hold all that sensitive personal information. A recent ruling in Europe has cast doubt about the way information is stored abroad and transferred to the U.S., and there are questions in Europe about what rights the U.S. government has over a room full of computers across the Atlantic. The BBC's Simon Jack reports.
Okay, so we've come to a business park about 20 miles outside of Dublin. Just like an industrial estate you would expect, but some of the biggest names in technology are all around us. PayPal, Symantec, IBM, eBay. Yeah, I think that's the... Oh, we can't get through there. That's the exit only. Don't appear to want to let us in. I wonder why.
Hello?
I'm from the BBC to do an interview.
Not a problem. Gate's opening for you now.
Thank you very much.
Reception's halfway up the building.
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
So I'm Mehdi Kilban of Dataplex Data Centres, and I'm the CEO of the company.
Okay, in we go.
So we have biometric doors going into the facility, so that everybody has to be fingerprinted.
I've just stuck to this. What's this? Okay.
This is like a sticky mat.
So it's like a sort of fly trap.
But effectively what it does, it just takes that residual dirt off the bottom of your shoe so that you're not bringing any dirt into the data hall itself. Okay. Very fine particles of dust and everything are not great in an environment where you've got servers. And so we try and keep it as clean as we can.
Okay.
Once we get into the data hall, the security level goes up in terms of the biometrics. So we've got fingerprint and we've also got swipe access on all of our doors going into the data hall.
We're in.
We've got what we call pods. So our pods here are 22 racks, and the racks then house and contain the servers and the switching equipment to allow our clients to run their businesses from here.
So this is the cloud. We're in the cloud.
We're in a facility that is housing the cloud.
Okay. And so looking at these servers here, things like my shopping details or my bank account numbers or that kind of stuff is whizzing through these machines.
Potentially, if you're a client of any of these customers in here, then your data and your information will be stored in here. Why we have such levels of security? Because your data is very important to you and it's important to our clients, and we make sure that the data is protected at a physical level as well as a network level as far as we possibly can.
Now that is just one room in one data center. A forest of these have grown up around Dublin. Amazon already has 7 and plans for 4 more. So why is Ireland becoming the cloud capital of Europe? Is it just down to that juicy tax rate of 12.5%? Shane Nolan is from IDA, Ireland's investment development agency.
I think it's quite interesting because when we talk to folks from other European countries, the assumption is, well, Ireland is all about tax. And from a competitive position, we're very comfortable if every other country thinks that that's our only competitive advantage, because the other elements of our offering are more difficult to replicate. Infrastructure, talent, immigration systems, track record.
We've come to Web Summit, which is a major technology event held here in Dublin every year. As we've seen, much of the cloud actually ends up here in Ireland, in the data centres that we've seen. And the question is, who has the rights to it? Who's protecting it? Who can come and fish for it? These are fundamental questions that are provoking questions among journalists here and elsewhere.
So I'm Carla Nillington, and I'm a technology journalist and columnist with the Irish Times. If there's no agreement on data transfer right now, which there isn't, we're all kind of floating around in this limbo until something gets decided on how data is going to move safely back and forth. In addition to that, there's a big question over whether the U.S. government can demand that a U.S. company, even if its data center is abroad, hand over information without going through the usual law enforcement routes, just a direct request. And as a journalist, I think all these issues are so important, so critical. They're abstract, they're difficult to understand, but citizens are affected by these, businesses are affected by these, governments are affected by these, and we as journalists have the role, I think, to try to make these issues clearer to our listeners, our readers, our viewers.
That's the BBC's Simon Jack. The body positivity movement has been steadily gaining momentum. That's the idea that everyone should love their body just as it is, even when it doesn't conform to societal standards of beauty. One of the prominent voices in that movement is Tucson author Jess Baker. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry talked with her about her new book, Things No One Will Tell Fat Girls. And Sarah joins me. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Mark.
So what are the things that Baker says no one will tell fat girls?
Well, it turns out lots of things. For example, we often don't think about the way marketing and advertising constantly reinforce the idea that our body isn't right. And that's not just true of people who aren't thin. It's also true of people who are differently abled or who don't present traditional forms of masculinity or femininity. So I started by talking with Jess about the word fat and why it was important to put it in the title of the book.
The reality is that the word fat is not inherently bad, and to be fat is not bad either. It's just a word that we've put so much negativity around and that we feel like it's a negative thing. Fat is a descriptor of size. I am fat. Bob Saget is tall. The clouds are fluffy. You know, all of those kinds of things. My shoes are black. It's all the same. And so it's important to have fat in the title because you're kind of taking away the negative stigma when you use it in a positive sense.
And at what point do you think that being fat or being heavy or even simply being not thin became such a negative thing, such a thing that you had to avoid?
The obesity parasite, quote unquote, started back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. So it's been going around for a long time. Way back then, you know, it's better to be larger because food was scarce and illnesses were everywhere. So if you were bigger, you were healthier. And that eventually changed, right? So food became more available, transportation came, everyone was filling out. We had some migrant workers come, they were shorter, stockier. You couldn't really tell who was rich and who was poor. And so the richer people, of course, wanted to be special and wanted everyone to know they were special just by looking at them. So they decided that because everyone had filled out, being larger was no longer the way to look wonderful. And so they decided that you need to be slender. And it actually was contested a lot, largely documented, contested by physicians at the time. They were like, why is fashion starting to dictate our health? Hold on a second. But as we are wont to do, we follow the money. And so physicians eventually did cave, of course. And, you know, then we see the roaring 20s, which is the epitome of the slender body. And it does fluctuate and change because we have social reflexes. So you will see different body types over decades. But it's important to know that it's always meant to be unattainable, that 5% of women today naturally have the body that we see in the media, 5%. which means that 95% will likely never, ever, ever have that body. So it's, you know, made to be unattainable. And then we're told that our worth lies in that and that we will be happy if we obtain that. And really, it just keeps us trapped. It really does.
You've been a spokesperson for body love for a long time. And I always sort of wonder, for you, when you hit a point where you realized, oh my God, I hate my body, but I don't have to, and I want to learn to love my body as it is, what is the process of not just deconstructing all of these historical things that made you hate your body, but then what is the process of beginning to learn to love it? Like, how do you flip that switch?
I found every book I could possibly find written on body positivity. So I surrounded myself with that. I started following blogs that were positive. I started looking for people who believed, finding a community. I think that's so important. If you can't find that community in real life, which is the ultimate ideal, you can find it online. And then I also started to retrain my brain visually. And I think this is really, really important and really accessible to most people. We don't realize how easily we're conditioned by seeing magazines, when we check out at the grocery store, to what shows up in our Facebook feeds. This is why we have negative reactions to alternative bodies, we'll call them. The thing that made the difference for me was Tumblr. So I found all these body positive Tumblrs, and they had diverse bodies, all shapes, sizes, sexes, genders, abilities, races, everything. And I would scroll through my Tumblr feed every day. And I will be honest with you, in the very beginning, it was shocking. It was a little disconcerting. I wasn't sure. My brain did not know how to process larger bodies, disabled bodies, all kinds of other bodies positively, because we were not given that context. But the more I scrolled through, it became less weird. And when it became less weird on my Tumblr feed, it became less weird in real life. And after it became less weird in real life, it started to normalize my body.
That's Jess Baker, a writer based in Tucson and author of the new book, Things No One Will Tell Fat Girls.
And that's KJZZ, Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
Sunny skies, 71 degrees at KJZZ. It's the show at 2:48.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and 100% online option. Details about the Tuesday, November 17th info session at ellerembA.com.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with the Takeaways' John Hockenberry. There's a difference between hearing and listening, and many researchers think we're losing our ability to listen. With the development of technology, we were able to make recordings, reducing the need for careful listening. We live in a more chaotic world as well, and it's simply harder to listen with all the background noise in our lives. Despite these challenges, the new podcast Only Human, about how health shapes our lives, wants us to become better listeners.
Mary Harris is host and managing editor of Only Human, and she says that hearing loss and listening skills go together, and we humans rarely seek help or even suspect there's a problem.
There's really good evidence that 20% of people over the age of 12 have some kind of hearing loss that can affect their day-to-day communication, and almost none of them know about it, or they're too embarrassed to get it tested.
I wonder if it goes beyond embarrassment in the sense that the brain is kind of wired to work around stuff like this. So it involves hearing, but it also involves complicated psychological issues of, as you say, not wanting to let people know that you can't hear, but just developing communication strategies that just incorporate the hearing loss. And so it can be undetectable.
That's right. So we can get used to it. And some of the most interesting and intriguing research right now, I think, is going on at Johns Hopkins, where there's a researcher who's shown that these workarounds, when we ignore what's happening with our ears, it might have a real impact on our brains, because it's working our brains really hard when we have to fill in the gaps. So his research looks at Alzheimer's, and he shows an association between hearing loss and Alzheimer's. Now, it's really hard to tell where the chicken and the egg is with something like that. But his studies now are all about seeing if giving hearing aids to people earlier, when they really should be getting them, when they may not be getting them because they're too embarrassed, can stall the Alzheimer's a little bit.
It's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, it points up why hearing loss is really this interesting window on the brain, as well as this important attribute that we need to get along.
Well, yeah, it's our fastest sense. That was another thing that was fascinating when we looked into this. So when we were evolving, you needed to be able to hear the snap of a twig if a predator was coming after you. And so your hearing never shuts off. Even when you're asleep, your brain is processing sound. There's a new set of researchers in Chicago who are actually looking at hearing as a window into the brain more generally. What they're doing is they're analyzing how we process sound from the youngest ages. They've found that it's linked up with all sorts of other things. So this researcher, Nina Krause, who's at Northwestern, she can give a hearing test to three-year-olds. It's looking not at the ears, but at the brain.
Mm.
And what it shows is that she can predict dyslexia later. She can say, oh, you know, the hearing's a little bit off here. How we process sound is a little bit off. And I think that may lead to some reading problems. She's even found hearing differences in people who have autism. So it really is an overall measure of brain health, which is fascinating.
So we get tested for, you know, alarming things like breast cancer, prostate cancer. We get tested for eye, you know, our ability to see all the time. Hearing tests, not so much. Why?
Well, we do get tested when we're born. Every newborn in the United States is tested for hearing. But then we're not really tested again. They used to test kids in school.
One data point doesn't really help you so much, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So we're giving people a way to do that now.
Right.
We have this app we're partnering with, Mimi. You can go to onlyhuman.org/listenup. You can download it and you can take the test. It's really fun. I didn't know what to expect. Yeah.
I took it.
How old are your ears?
Well, let me just say that the test really tests you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like I remember in elementary school where, you know, it seemed sort of easy. What could this possibly show? Maybe my hearing was better. Who knows? But it's just the way that it does it in terms of duration and the visual interaction between what you hear and what you see is very well done. And you really do get a sense that your ears are getting actually tested. Because of that, I was terrified.
I was too.
To hit the key that said result.
Right.
But it turns out my ears are younger than my actual age.
My hearing age was 18. It was like the best news
I got
all day. Yep.
Don't try to put anything by you. We can't sneak up on Mary Harris.
Don't do it.
So that means now you're listening to music that 18-year-olds listen to, like Katy Perry.
A lot of Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift, yeah. There are different ways of losing your hearing, right?
Yeah, there are different ways. So the thing to know is that hearing loss isn't as bad as it used to be because there's all sorts of occupational now. It used to be that you were exposed to a lot more noise in your everyday life and it affected you. So that's the good news. The bad news is that we're all listening to music in our earbuds all the time and we're really not sure what that's doing to our hearing. And so taking a test like the Mimi test lets you sort of check in and see, where am I? You know, how are my ears? Are they measuring up?
What's the technology of hearing aids these days? You've got everything from headphones to cochlear implants in terms of the technology to restore hearing. What does that have to do with all of this?
Well, so what I think is really interesting, we interviewed a guy named Jay for this series who is deaf. And what he does is he uses his phone. He has an app on his phone, so he can just be walking down the street with this and talking to people, and they don't know that he has a hearing problem necessarily because he's able to use an app on his phone that amplifies the sound.
I see. Should our listeners, whether they can hear us well or not, should they be a part of this community on Only Human?
They absolutely should. So onlyhuman.org/listenup. You can take the test and you can also stay tuned because next week, once you know your hearing age, we're going to be doing a whole project on listening. So even if you hear great, I'm sure you've been told, are you really listening to me? And we're going to give you a way to listen a little bit better.
Now, is the whole idea here, correct me if I'm wrong, so that you can listen better and be a more empathetic kind of person for your Thanksgiving dinner? Is that the idea here? Is that really the idea here?
It's kind of the Olympics of listening, isn't it? We talk to all these experts in listening, memory, and all of it comes down to you have to decide to pay attention. You have to remember to remember. You have to really invest. And it's a little bit about centering yourself before you go into conversation and making sure that you're there.
So a project of engaging one's heart with one's brain, with one's hearing, and the first step is to figure out how well, you can hear. That's what the folks at Only Human are doing. Mary, you don't look a day over 18.
At least my ears.
That's right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mary Harris is host and managing editor of Only Human, WNYC's podcast about how health shapes our lives. To keep up with their Listen Up project, subscribe to the Only Human podcast and find out your hearing age. Take the hearing test. It's easy. All you have to do is search for the iPhone app called Mimi. And hey, folks, listen better, won't you?
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Painter Frida Kahlo was known for her self-portraits, but a new exhibit at the Heard Museum shows Kahlo on film rather than on a canvas. Frida Kahlo, her photos, is now open. Joining me to talk about it is Janet Cantley, a curator at the Heard Museum. And Janet, what's the exhibit about?
It's a traveling exhibit that was organized in Mexico City at the Blue House Museum. And that's actually the Blue House is the place that Frida Kahlo lived. She was born there, lived a lot of her life there, and she died there. And then her husband, Diego Rivera, who was also a famous painter and muralist, gave the house, the residence, and all of its contents to Mexico, for the people of Mexico.
And are these photos of Frida Kahlo and of her life?
Basically, yes. There are six sections of the exhibit, and it all focuses on Frida Kahlo. They were from her personal archives, which numbered over 6,500 images. In the traveling show, we have 240 images, and it goes everything from her family history, her ancestry, to focusing on Casa Azul. It talks about politics, revolutions, and Diego. That's one of the sections. There's one on Frida's loves and one on photography, and a final one on her broken body.
Did she take any of the photos herself? I mean, I know she's known as a painter, not a photographer, but are any of these her images?
Right. There are a handful of images that are either signed by her or attributed to her. And what's great is to look at these images in terms of her painting and see how she used them as working tools.
How do you sort of maybe reevaluate her life and her art based on what you're seeing in these photographs?
You know, I think it's just such an insight into her life because you learn about her family, that her mother was from Oaxaca, and that's where she sought her indigenous roots and in terms of her style of clothing and everything. And you learn about her father, who is a photographer, a professional photographer, and definitely had an influence on Frida throughout her life. And then, you know, everything about the Casa Azul, and there was this stream of people in the 1930s that came through, famous Mexican actors and actresses, people from the U.S. And she also developed a lot of friendships with photographers.
So photography was clearly a big part of her life, even if it wasn't her main medium.
Right. That's probably what started her off in the arts. She worked with her father. She was very close to her father. She was the third daughter, and there's a quote from Guillermo Kahlo that said that she was the most intelligent daughter, the most like him. So, yeah. So she went with him on when he was doing his photographic assignments. He was commissioned to photograph government buildings in Mexico. And she accompanied him and then worked with him in the lab touching up photos. So she learned a lot about photography.
Knowing her art, as you must, do you see elements of what she painted in what you see in the photographs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really been fun to do. You know, we do docent training for the guides that will be taking public through the exhibit. And I gave them a PowerPoint showing them the examples of photographs and how they were used to compose some of her paintings.
Does it sort of give you more insight into what she painted, having seen maybe some of the backstory in the photographs?
Yes, definitely. Especially, I mean, there is the section that's called Her Broken Body. It talks about how she had to deal with pain, both physical and emotional, throughout her life. And so I think that really gives you an insight when you actually see her in bed, in traction, or with a corset, a medical corset on, and how she had to lay reclined while she was painting, and she had an easel built that she could use while she was in bed. So I think that really kind of gives you insight as to how painting was something that she turned to when she was having to deal after her surgeries or after her serious accident she had when she was 18.
Janet Cantley is a curator at the Heard Museum. The exhibit Frida Kahlo, Her Photos, runs through early February at the museum. Janet, thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm joined now by Steve Goldstein, my friend and colleague, who, in addition to hosting this program, is also the host of KJZZ's Here and Now tomorrow morning at 11. So, Steve, what do you got?
Mark, it's a Veterans Day-themed program, as tomorrow, even though it's a Wednesday,
does
fall on Veterans Day. We'll be talking with the family of Ernest McFarland, who was Arizona governor, also Senate Majority Leader, and Arizona Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Also, we'll be talking with an Arizona novelist who used to be a naval pilot.
Huh. That's KJZZ's Here and Now, that and much more tomorrow on KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11, right here on 91.5. The show is produced by our senior producers Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. Our news director, Al Macias. Executive producer, John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. You can reach us at the show at kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Oncology, together with the U.S. Oncology Network, bringing evidence-based cancer care to communities across Phoenix. Together, a better way to fight cancer. More at arizonaoncology.com.